have a more informal dialogue amongst people who are involved in mental health care in this community and who might benefit from thinking about alternatives that they might not have heard about before, and who might not have an opportunity to come together, actually, in this way. I know there are people here from a variety of different venues and groups and so on. And I would say I personally don't know everyone here, so I think it would be really useful if we would go around the room and have people introduce themselves. Does that seem okay? But all I'm mainly taking the floor for a minute now is to say that there's no formal agenda here. I promised Phil and Rufus they were not giving formal presentations at this event. They're giving them tonight. That we would have a dialogue about, I think the one thing, no matter who's in this room and no matter what perspective we're coming from, I think we could all agree that there are a lot of people in this community who are distressed and who do not find as much help of the right kind as they need. So I think probably we could all agree on that, and that opportunities to talk about ways to respond more directly to people's needs might be really helpful for all of us. But, as I say, there's no formal agenda, and I think we should embrace the...
Rufus, I'll tell you a bit more about me in a minute.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm Phil Thomas, and I'll tell you a bit more about me in a minute.
Okay.
Go on. Yeah. We should do. We shouldn't keep doing this a bit.
Right, so yeah, so I'm very pleased to be here. I've read a book by Edward Podvol about recovery from insanity, something like that, and it mentions Windhorse, and so, and was very interested in the processes that he's promoting and the idea of therapeutic communities. So it's good to be here. I've got a kind of interest in working with unusual states of mind, states of distress, states of madness, call them what you will. When I was 18, I had a lot of unusual beliefs and intense experiences, and my parents didn't feel able to manage me, and I ended up being put into psychiatric hospital, and I was given a diagnosis of schizophrenia and given quite high doses of neuroleptic medication, so what gets called antipsychotic medication. And I found this approach very unsatisfactory. Also, I was shocked by the way a lot of friends kind of felt too afraid to visit me and felt abandoned. So I was kind of interested in that process as well. Like, why is it like this? I guess there was always that question in the back of my mind, and how within the institution of the psychiatric hospital a very different kind of regime seemed to exist and it was quite a hard system to get out of, you know. And the kind of meeting with doctors were very powerful kind of ceremonies where you were kind of, your identity was framed in a certain way, and you were talked to as if you weren't there, kind of thing. You didn't feel heard. But the power of the ceremony being a room with lots of people in, and the way you were talked to kind of gave it this kind of magic. You came out of that wondering what had really gone on in there. You know, I was very lucky in some ways that there was a powerful story of recovery in my family, and my mother had a brain hemorrhage when I was 11, and I'd witnessed my father getting a circle of friends around to help her do different physiotherapy exercises and help her recover mentally, because she was regressed mentally and physically by the brain operation. And I saw a very powerful recovery, which was partly about her determination and partly about lots of people supporting her and kind of gathering round and coming each day doing different. things with her. So I think that instilled me with this kind of story of hope, so that even though I was being told a different story, that I had this kind of brain disorder and I had to take medication for the rest of my life, it was not something I bought into. So 20 years later, I work as a psychologist, and I've been working for the last 10 years as a psychologist. So I trained as a psychologist and went back into the mental health system in order to try and promote change in society towards acute states of distress or confusion or mysticism, or misunderstood states of mind. So, and then about 7 years ago, I started being open about my former experiences. So I kept very quiet to avoid discrimination, and I lied on application forms and things like that to get to train as a psychologist and to get funding from the health service. But then saw it as an important part of the kind of campaign to start being open about myself, if you like, and joined with others really in trying to change society's approach to mental health and create, positive examples of ways to be with people, and that journey led me to make links with the Hearing Voices Network. So in the UK, there's a group called the Hearing Voices Network that aim to promote self-help and understanding around hearing voices, the experience of hearing voices. And through that I met Phil about 7 years ago, and I can tell you more about hearing voices later, and about 4 years ago came up to Bradford from London. So I've lived in London all my life, which is a big city, and then I moved up north to Bradford, where there was more open-minded workers like Phil, and than what you call survivors, just people, more open-minded people. Yeah, and I've been developing kind of self-help groups in Bradford, both within services and outside of services, could tell you a bit more about that maybe, but because I kind of went into the system, the mental health system, into this clinical psychology and the psychiatric system. I went in as a kind of spy, really.
And you were going to say that. Just about to say spy.
Yeah. And as an agent provocateur, to sort of a sleeper who after 10 years woke up, and started to become an activist within the system to help dismantle the unhelpful aspects of it. Not the whole thing, but the unhelpful aspects to start to try and... But then I also realised that the revolution has to come from outside and inside as well. That really the system will only change when society demands for it to change, and when newspapers start saying, why aren't people in distress being given real choice? Why aren't we respecting people in distress as equals? So I'm interested in not just creating self-help groups, but how can you change community attitudes? So how can you, like maybe Gay Pride has done, or the civil rights movement, how can you consciousness raise in the communities that we live in? Okay, I was going to, yeah.
I was just, maybe you could mention a couple of the specific things you've done. I remember a video that you showed me, and
right.
And the also the arts group that you have.
Yeah, Evolving Minds, yeah, sure. Yeah, so there was an artist called Aidan Shingler who has made a lot of art about his psychotic experiences, his experiences of... give an example of some of his artwork.
The Kiss It logo is a good example.
Yeah, I mean, the Kiss It logo was a Valentine's card that was delivered to the Prime Minister in our country, Tony Blair, and it was a heart on the front cover, was a heart.
Pink
classic.
Heart.
So you do have Valentine's Day
here?
Mm. Oh, yes. Yeah.
I think we invented it.
See? Well, you certainly promoted it. So Valentine's Day, that kind of image, an arrow going into a heart, and then when you opened up, the image just changed slightly to become a couple of buttocks with a syringe going in. Mm. So, and it said, "Have a heart," mm-hmm. and it was about campaigning against forced treatment in hospitals. Aidan Shingler. We got this march together on Valentine's Day where we marched on Downing Street and various other places and the old original Bedlam. So you've heard of Bedlam?
Mm-hmm.
So the original, it's 750-year-old institution, the original site, the original psychiatric asylum. There have been a number of protest events to raise awareness about the use of force and the psychological kind of damaging effects of force. We decided to meet the demonstrators in style. So the demonstrators were meeting in Manchester and we decided to come from 30 miles away by foot and push a psychiatric bed. So to escape symbolically from a private psychiatric hospital in pyjamas with a bed. And we were chased by a giant syringe. And we got a lot of publicity because it was fun, as well as being about serious issues, it was fun. Generally a good response from passers-by, and we gave out leaflets, and we had a big syringe that squirted water at people, and we on one of these bed pushes we had an ECT electroshock. Mm. We had an electroshock machine. We were offering the public free electroshocks,
which surprisingly nobody took up.
Had to pay $2,000 a shot for them.
And the we never quite worked out. You have to pay.
I did.
Yeah, right.
I had to pay $2,000.
No National Health Service in the United States.
Yeah, yeah, it's, yeah. That's right. It's all free. in the UK. And the funny thing was that we had a dummy on the bed that we were rescuing, and the mask on the dummy, it was actually a mask of George Bush.
That's right.
What was that?
So people would say, give him the electroshock treatment, he needs it. But I'm not sure why we were rescuing George Bush. It made an interesting kind of edge to it. But yeah, we believe in everybody can recover. So, yeah. So even George Bush. And and we found if you took the mask off, it was Tony Blair underneath. So, yeah, yeah. And then, yeah, a public meeting that we do once a month is called... I'll tell you about that in a bit. Or shall I? Well, there's a meeting called Evolving Minds that we set up. There's a film called Evolving Minds that was made by somebody who'd been given force treatment in hospital for acute states of psychosis, or where she was felt, you know, she was seen as out of control, and she wanted to know what would be alternative ways, as other than just being shut down with medication, what would be alternative ways of coping. So she made a film with a community filmmaking organisation called Evolving Minds, and in the film she interviews a Buddhist monk, a shaman, a nutritional therapist, and a psychologist with kind of spiritual interests, a British psychologist called Isabel Clark, and it's an interesting film, and it's just looking at different approaches to well-being and to managing how you might manage journeying into the unconscious or journeying into altered states of consciousness or the spirit world or whatever you want to call it, kind of thing. But how might you manage that journey in a way where you stay in control and other people don't feel they have to take you know, the reins, as it were. So we showed that in my hometown, which is a bit like Northampton, sort of like a British version of Northampton called Hebden Bridge. And we got about 60 people, 70 people come and watch this film on a freezing cold, rainy night. And there was a really good, vibrant discussion afterwards. Some people saying, well, my nephew's on Ritalin and he's found it really helpful. And other people saying, well, I see my illness as a spiritual journey. And just a broad range of ideas and positions. And we thought, well, it'd be really good to have regular meetings like this. So we create a mailing list, and every month we have a meeting. We get about 25 to 35 people coming, and we try and create a public meeting. So it's kind of trying to create a space where we put forward different approaches to mental well-being, emotional well-being. But we also might... and we always have art at the beginning. We always have poetry or music at the beginning to warm us up as well. And we might discuss all sorts of things. I mean, we might discuss a specific problem, like how do we deal with paranoia? Or we might look at how does war affect us emotionally? And everyone's welcome to come to these meetings. We want a broad range of people to come, and you know, it could be anyone with an interest in personal well-being, you know. And we had, for the how does war affect us emotionally, we had two veterans of the Second World War talking about, one was a conscientious objector and one was somebody whose father was killed in the Second World War, and they both talked about the impact of war and their families, and it was really interesting. And we always create some space for discussion. We always promote the idea there's no one best way to see these things. That we just respect each other's different points of view, and that everyone's got wisdom and expertise about these matters. You know, it's not only in the people we think might have expertise and wisdom, kind of thing. And the expertise of personal experience is an important narrative or story we need to listen to, because it hasn't been listened to for hundreds of years. So we need to kind of give that a bit of space. Mm-hmm. But we don't say that's the only expertise, kind of thing. We try and create space for people to talk from the eye about what they've been through and stuff. So that, yeah, that's a bit about me and what I do. I was very pleased to come and work with Phil, and it's been very helpful working with Phil, because he, up to recently, he was working as a psychiatrist, and we worked in the same team. up to about a year or two, year ago. Mm-hmm. And that's very helpful, I guess, when you're working with like-minded people, and it gives you a sense of strength, and you don't feel like you have to look over your shoulder quite as much. Mm-hmm. You still do, but...
but yeah. We're looking over our shoulders together.
Yeah, yeah, there you go.
That's the difference.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
Shall I say a little bit about myself, really? I spent the first 18 years of my life in North Wales, and I was born into an ordinary sort of working class background, and at the age of 18 I went to medical school in Manchester to train to be a doctor. I'd always decided at an early age I wanted to do psychiatry. I was really interested in issues around the mind, philosophy, the relationship between body and mind, and mind and the world. I was sort of always quite strange, really. But I went to Manchester because I wanted to go and watch Manchester United play football, the best football team in the world. So I went to Manchester. And I went through medical school, and I ended up doing my psychiatric training in Edinburgh. I went to Edinburgh in 1978 and trained, which is in Edinburgh, it's a historic city, a very old university, and a great place to study. I was a lecturer in Edinburgh, and I gave lectures there on philosophy to psychiatrists in training, lectured them on Freud and the post-Freudians, Karen Horney and all those people, and the ideas of Martin Heidegger and other existential philosophies, even anti-psychiatry. I gave them talks in those days. I was very interested in the ideas of Ronnie Lang. I still think The Divided Self is the greatest work in the 20th century about madness. That's my personal view. I know Lang gets attacked a great deal, but I really do think there are some profound insights in that book about the nature of distress, and not just the nature of distress, but the problems of that psychiatry poses to people who are in those states. I think Lang was a genius, no matter what happened to him later in his life. And I say that also to give you some sort of idea about how different psychiatry was in those days. In those days, this is going back 30 years, it was an exciting place to be, that we were encouraged to think critically, and for ourselves, we were exposed to a wide range of ideas. We read Goffman, Asylums, it's another really important piece of work. Lang, as I've said, the philosophers, not that I really understood Heidegger, but I know a man who does. And I'll talk about that shortly. I'll come on to back to Heidegger. So I was a lecturer in Edinburgh, and I got involved in research and teaching. And in 1983, I became a consultant. That's when I became a practitioner in my own right as a sort of senior member of the profession. And I moved from Edinburgh, to Manchester to go and work in the hospital that I'd trained in as a student. And in medicine, one of the greatest honours that you can be paid as a doctor is to go back and work as a consultant in the hospital that you trained at. It's a great honour. And I was, really excited and thrilled and felt very privileged to be in that situation, because Manchester's a great city, and it's a fantastic place, wonderful people, and I very closely bonded to Manchester. My wife's from the city, and my daughter was born there, and it has the greatest football team in the world, although Rufus will contest that, because Rufus, being a North London kid, is an Arsenal fan, and there's not a lot of love lost between Arsenal and Manchester United. Anyway, that's by the by. Now, I started my new job in Manchester in September 1983. I just think, Gail, you talk so much about the importance of narrative, and I think in terms of understanding where I'm coming from, I'm going to tell you a little bit about my own narrative. I think it's a really useful thing to do, as Rufus has indeed. So, 1983, I went to Manchester as a consultant, and what happened on the first day of my new job was one of those sort of road to Damascus type experiences where the scales begin, they're not completely fall from your eyes, but begin. You begin to realise there are cracks through which light appears, even though, if initially, it's not entirely clear where what the significance of the light is. And what I noticed, without really beginning to understand it, was of the 20-odd beds in the hospital where I had beds, I walked in that Monday morning, of the 20-odd, 24 beds, 22 of them were occupied by young African-Caribbean men. And this struck me as completely strange because I'd come from Edinburgh, I'd done most of my training there, and there was nothing in my training that prepared me for this. I was brought up with the naive sort of scientific belief that schizophrenia is a universal. It affects all people sort of equally in all cultures and at all times. So why should there be such an overrepresentation of young black men in this hospital? And I was really troubled by this. I was really puzzled by it. And my perplexity and concern grew when I spoke with these men and tried to do the psychiatrist bit and question them carefully and to find out from them what was going on. And as I spoke to them and questioned them clinically, I couldn't see any sort of experiences that they had that I had been trained as a psychiatrist to identify as, let's say, first-rank symptoms of schizophrenia, or, you know, the sorts of particular types of voice-hearing experiences, or the particular types of unusual and strange beliefs that people have that psychiatrists recognise as being the sine qua non, the absolutely vital signs and indicators of schizophrenia. I couldn't see any of that. Sure, these guys were behaving strangely. Sometimes it was difficult to follow what they were saying. They were quite angry, some of them, and, you know, I personally didn't feel too threatened, but clearly people around did. And I just was completely perplexed by this. And so I began to wonder what's going on here. So I decided that the only way I could try and make sense out of what was going on was to go and talk to the families of these young men to see what take they had on the trajectories, upon the sort of life stories that had led to their sons, usually sons, sometimes daughters, but usually sons and brothers ending up in these places. And so, and this was another sort of one of those moments that changes. I arranged through my secretary to go and talk to the mother of one particular young guy in Moss Side, which is right in the heart of Manchester's African Caribbean community. And I went on a Tuesday morning, and he knocked on the door. And what struck me in this lady's response was the fear in her eyes. Now, I'd gone there as a doctor. I was going there. I wanted to try and help. I wanted to try and know what was going on, to understand, to try and see, you know, if she could make sense. But it was clear to me that whatever it was I thought I represented to her wasn't shared by her. And what was I eventually came to understand that what she actually thought I was, she thought I was some sort of policeman. And that was one of the first things that really drew my attention to the role that psychiatry plays mm-hmm. in society mm-hmm. to do with controlling people, policing psychiatry, policing people's behaviour, definitions around what seemed to be normal, around what one might loosely call the social control agenda of psychiatry, which has been so well described by a number of philosophers, most notably Michel Foucault, as I later came to find out. So I then started another journey, which was to try, and I'd started linking into various community groups. We had a wonderful hostel in Manchester, which is still going, called George Jackson House. George Jackson, probably you will know who George Jackson was. A very powerful figure in black history, and they named the hostel. This was a hostel for young, homeless black men in Manchester, and I suddenly realised that these people were doing fantastic work supporting young African Caribbean men. They were who were in crises, who were in spiritual and emotional distress, many of whom had contact with psychiatrists, and many of them, if they had been seen by psychiatrists there and then would almost certainly have ended up in hospital on sections of the Mental Health Act as compulsory patients. So that was another important thing, my realisation that actually there were support networks, there were networks of understanding within local communities, systems of belief, strengths, assets in poor communities that actually did fantastic jobs in supporting members of those communities through difficult times. So that was another important eye-opener. And then towards the... we did a lot of... It was a very sort of crude form of what I now recognise to be called community development, but I didn't know about these things in those days. And I might come back to community development shortly. Then I began sort of towards the end of the 80s to get more and more angry with my professional colleagues because we were a new service, we didn't have a lot of resources, there were a lot of discussions about going on about what sort of resources we should have. And I was saying, look, you know, you don't know what's going on out in those communities. I've been there and I've seen it, and there's a lot of fantastic work going on out there in those communities. And we need to be investing resources in supporting those people who are doing those jobs. And they said, oh, go, you know, this is bullshit. You know, this is, we've got some of the most dangerous patients in the country here. We need, we've got very few beds. We need a big new Stalagluft 3 or whatever you want to call it. We need a big institution to lock people up in. And I, in the end, I got so pissed off with this. I said, thank you very much. I'm leaving. It's either, you know, either I'm fighting a losing battle here. So, and I was getting, at this point, I was getting completely disenchanted with my profession, and I was, to be frank, was on the verge of giving up psychiatry altogether. And so I went through really, at that point in my life, quite a difficult time in personal terms. I was very disenchanted. I was very, you probably gathered from what I'm saying, quite a stubborn bastard, really, when it comes to it. I knew I was right, and I was determined that I wasn't going to let these people. So anyway, I felt the only way I could preserve my sanity was to walk away from it. And I ended up going to a job in North Wales, which is where I was from. It was a sort of, I suppose, looking back, it was a sort of an attempt to rediscover my roots. But I'm not a Welsh speaker, so it wasn't altogether a successful venture. But I really, it was a really important move in my life because what happened was I then began to meet another group of people, a completely different group of people, who helped me to see things in a slightly different way. And one of the key people in this is a guy, some of you here will have heard of this guy called Ron Coleman. Have you heard of, come across Ron Coleman? Ron is a charismatic working class Scot from Dundee who was slammed up in the psychiatric system, diagnosed schizophrenic because he heard voices, and Ron was incensed by this. And this was in Manchester in the 80s when I was there, but our paths didn't cross. Ron got involved with Marius Rom, and Ron was really one of the dynamic forces in the early days. Rufus has mentioned the Hearing Voices Network. Ron was one of the key sort of survivor sort of leaders who took forward the work of Marius Rom and Zandra Escher in England. And I think it's fair to say, although, you know, Ron's in some ways quite a controversial figure, I don't think the Hearing Voices Network, or indeed the sort of survivor movement in England, would be where it is today without a lot of the energy that he put in those early days. And I got very friendly with Ron, and a small group of us began to meet, radical, critical survivors like Ron, and a couple of other people like Lou Pembroke, who was involved in setting up the National Self-Harm Network and Survivors Speak Out. A small group of people, really, who were radical survivor activists. And I was talking with Ron one day about, you know, I was in this real dilemma, didn't know what to do, and about whether I should give up psychiatry or what I should do. And I think he was getting a bit pissed off with this sort of rather effete middle class sort of introspective guy who was whinging about his future. And he said, oh, for fuck's sake, Phil, I could try and do his Scottish accent. You're much more fucking used to the survivor movement inside being a psychiatrist than you are outside. And I think that is a really very sound piece of advice that he gave me. What he was saying was that And it goes into what Rufus was saying earlier, that in order to change systems, you have to work both inside it and outside it. And from inside, you have to try and subvert it, and you have to try and subvert it as well from outside. So that really sort of made my mind up that I was going to stick in, and I would just try and work in a line. I began to realise that actually the best thing I could do as a professional and as a critical professional was to work in alliance, not in partnership, because partnerships imply equality, and I don't believe there can ever be equality in terms of power or whatever between doctors or psychiatrists or professionals, for that matter, and survivors, but in alliance, because alliances imply that you may have come from different perspectives, but you're actually working towards a common aim. And so it was that sort of really spurred me on. And I, in Wales, I came to work with an amazing group of people, both survivors and other critical professionals. And then, about 12 years ago, I met a guy called Pat Bracken at a conference in Prague, I think, the first time. And because I'm going back now to my philosophy, I was beginning to realise in terms of the decision I'd made to stay in, that the way psychiatry was going, it was becoming far more biological, it was becoming far more preoccupied with the neuroscience agenda was dominating. This was in the middle of the decade of the brain, the 1990s. And so I met Pat, and Pat had worked in Africa. He's a psychiatrist. He'd worked on Save the Children, and was also studying philosophy, was reading philosophy, was a Heidegger scholar. And so Pat had just at that point had just moved to Bradford to set up the home treatment service, and the first thing he did when he got there was to appoint Peter Relton as a survivor, as the service user development worker. So Bradford, the home treatment service in the mid-90s, was being set up as one of the first mainstream sort of services that was actually set up with a service user development worker right at the heart of the service, before even all the other staff were appointed. It was so important for Pat that there was a service user survivor perspective on team appointments right from the beginning. And I just knew that what Pat was trying to do was right, and so I then moved from Wales and worked with Pat. I didn't work on home treatment. I worked very closely with home treatment, but we worked clinically together. And at about that time, my first book was also published, and that was quite well received at the time. And I had an invitation from the editor of Open Mind magazine, which is a sort of main sort of mental health sort of journal, really, in England. It's National Mind's house magazine. And she wanted to know if I'd like to write a regular column. And so I thought I couldn't do this by myself. So Pat and I had a regular column together, which we decided to call Post-Psychiatry, in which we started to spell out some of the sort of problems, as we saw it as critical psychiatrists, of clinical practice in psychiatry, about its failure to engage with the meaning of people's experiences, its arrogance, its claims to have global, universal understandings of people's distress, no matter what their cultural background or even their time in history, and really about the need, which I'm going to talk about a little bit this evening, about the need for what we call a democratic debate about our emotions, the way we understand ourselves, and at the same time, we were trying to marry that alongside, because there's no point having great ideas unless they're grounded in some sort of practice or praxis, as the Germans call it, a sort of Marxist expression. And so, really, people like Rufus coming to work in Bradford was just, from our point of view, wonderful, because Rufus represents a particular challenge, both who he is as a human being, but also the ideas and the way he works represents a real challenge to the sort of mainstream ways of working that exist. And so that's why I say it's been fantastic to work in the same team and look over our shoulders together. So that's basically where where I've come from.
So what is it about how he works? Can you say more about that?
What about...
About how he works.
Yeah, well, it's about the way Rufus works with communities. It's about the way he, what he does, it seems to me, is tries to create what I would call safe spaces in the community where people can come together and share their understandings of their experiences without there being any sense of judgment or negative value that's born from professional understandings that... So that you go to an Evolving Minds meeting, and this is very much influenced, it seems to me, by, I should mention, another key person who influenced me was Marius Rom and Sandra Escher, the German Dutch psychiatrist and Sandra journalist, who really founded the Sharing Voices network in Holland. And I think that what that work is all about and what Rufus's work with Evolving Minds and the other groups that he's been involved in setting up is about enabling people to come together who can share their understandings without there being a dominant view or way of understanding what's going on, so that people can talk about unusual experiences in any number of different ways. They may be spiritual ways, they may be political ways, they may be cultural ways or understandings. They may be cognitive behavioural understandings, but that scientific system of understanding has to take its place as one of equal valence or value or importance alongside the others. It's not there dominating, accounting for all the others, which is the problem with Western scientific understandings. And that, to me, you know, this is something that, because Bradford, I was saying to Steve, we were talking earlier about Bradford and its multicultural, 60% of the inner city, part of Bradford, people from South Asian communities. What you begin to realise is that the sort of work that Rufus and is taking place now in this way around community development is absolutely vital also for people from non-Western cultures, because Western systems of thought, Western understandings about how we interpret ourselves, the sort of rational, materialistic interpretations of selfhood that we've inherited since the days of the European Enlightenment 300 years ago, that have led to modern scientific understandings of ourselves as human beings, for a great many people across the world are completely alien. And there's only one, well, two groups in the world whose interests are served by promulgating and propagating those Western understandings. One are global professional elites like the World Health Organization and the World Psychiatric Association, and the other, of course, is the global pharmaceutical industry. So my interpretation of the work that Rufus and others are involved in is this is part of, actually, it's about a struggle. It's about a democratic struggle, about the rights of ordinary people in local communities anywhere in the world to have their own say in determining how they are to understand themselves and to make sense of themselves, rather than having a particular view imposed upon them, being told that they have to think about their distress as part of, it's an illness called schizophrenia, or it's a disorder. Because that, to me, is really serving only... that is undemocratic. That is putting forward a particular set of views that only represents the interests of a very small number of powerful professional elites, or the people who have shares in pharmaceutical companies.
That's why, you know, I mean, one thing that I hope will happen in this area, and certainly I've been particularly inspired by Evolving Minds as an example of this, is for us to have many more venues in which we can have community dialogue about these kinds of things. For a couple of years, I know some of you have come, I sponsored a lot of films at Mount Holyoke in a series called Experiencing Madness, in which we had films that I purposefully got that were not the kind of films that psychology departments show, that were, you know, created by people who were trying to represent their own experience of madness. And I think in a way, you know, somewhat similar to what Phil was talking about doing as somebody who was, you know, a professional in those venues trying to work against them. You know, I always believe that people who are professionals and are in contexts where they have access to resources and someone should use them insofar as they possibly can in a different way. So, you know, I've gotten on Holyoke to buy all these films. So now anybody who wants to see them, even if you didn't come to the series a couple of years ago, they're all in the Mount Holyoke Library. They're all free. They're all accessible to people. And, I mean, I thought of that as one way. We had very diverse audiences coming to these showings, but I feel as if we could really use in this area something that is an egalitarian community forum that is not run by people who are psychologists or social workers or directors of this or that program, and where we could really invite people to come and talk about their experience from whatever points of view they wanted. So that, I mean, I just know myself in my own teaching that I'm always shocked by the fact that my well-educated students at Mount Holyoke never hear any other point of view but the biomedical model of mental illness. They think that depression is caused by a chemical imbalance. They think the dopamine theory of schizophrenia is correct. They just don't hear any other points of view. And, you know, these are people who are in an academic environment designed entirely to provide them with a liberal arts education in which they hear multiple points of view. So I feel as if anything that we would do as a group like this to foster more, you know, I know that Julie's working in Holyoke. I live in Holyoke myself. Holyoke is a town near here with a very large Puerto Rican, completely disenfranchised population with a very large number of people on some kind of government assistance or very, very poor who have no venues in which to express their point of view about how they're understanding their own experience. I think there's a lot of opportunities for us to do things like that, at least as a start.
It's interesting, Rufus and Phil, being from Bradford, because from what I know of Bradford, Bradford is very much like Holyoke.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you could, if I could just dive right into a question that relates to Windhorse in regard to medication use or not. And because I, like, even if a lot of these groups are available for folks, and I know a lot are available through the Freedom Center, what do you recommend to people who maybe they have been in mainstream medicine and they have been on medications for bipolar disorder or schizophrenia, and they're really afraid to come off the meds? Mm-hmm. Like, what kind of a setting of containment and safety do you recommend to folks if they want to slowly try coming off meds and exploring some of these other possibilities of looking at what's going on?
It sounds like you're going to ask if somebody's been on meds, if they want to come off, what support would you offer them?
Right.
Or are you asking if somebody's been on meds and they're too scared to come off, what are you asking me?
I think I'm asking you all of that.
All of that. Okay. So, well, I don't know. I think coming off medication is a really difficult thing to do. Maybe reducing it is a good thing to start with for many people who might be over sedated. But I think you need to learn other ways to cope with mood, because I think the main thing medication does is kind of dampen down mood swings, mood regulation. It sort of suppresses emotion, and so when you come off meds, you can have withdrawal problems, but you also have new, more intense moods or that return that you need to know how. You need to have ways of dealing with. So we've tried to create places like Tai Chi. So Tai Chi, or a lot of kind of body work where you can learn to regulate emotion. You know, I mean, meditation's another way, or yoga. So people who are either coming off meds or wanting to come off, preferably before they even start reducing, learning other techniques to manage mood and create balance. Because and then there's anticipating the withdrawal kind of effects. So Phil's written, I wrote a little bit in it, but Phil wrote the most an information leaflet about medication, which I've got in here. Pass. Have a look and pass it around. There's another one. But Phil could probably tell you about that. But basically, your brain, you're having dopamine transmission blocked. So your brain tries to compensate. Your brain builds up a tolerance to all drugs, so it always tries to recreate homeostasis. So to compensate for medication, your brain starts to create more dopamine receptors. So when you come off medication, you have more dopamine receptors than other people. And if something stressful or exciting happens, they all start firing and you can't sleep. And then people around you can think, oh, they're getting unwell. But it's more complicated than that. It's a withdrawal effect. So if you anticipate that, then you're not going to, and the people around you expect that, then it's less likely maybe to be misinterpreted, and people may be less anxious about it, and help you find ways to get some rest, maybe different ways through exercise or even medication in short term, benzodiazepines or and it depends, because there are problems if people are on for a long time. It can be very difficult to come off.
Absolutely.
You need to also go back and be prepared to, it's always I wouldn't say medications, I mean, a lot of people drink alcohol every day, it's not a bad thing. It's just about giving people real informed choices about how to manage their moods. Some people manage very well on low doses, and have very fulfilling lives, or medium doses. Everybody's different. It's not, we don't need to get too dualistic about off medication good, on medication, bad.
But I think the difficulty is that you're right about informed choices, but I think how do you inform people when there is, to be honest, I think I wouldn't say a conspiracy of silence about the problems of medication, but a failure on the part of the medical profession to face up to the reality that medication, long-term medication, damages people
mm-hmm.
and is harmful for them.
Mm-hmm.
And the person who's at the moment doing a lot of very thoughtful work, I think absolutely first-class work, is my friend and colleague Joanna Moncrief, who's a senior lecturer in University College in London in psychiatry. Jo's also co-chair with myself of Critical Psychiatry Network in the UK. Jo's written recently, including one with David Cohen from Florida, who's a professor of social work in Florida, a lovely guy. She's written three, I think, really important papers about this in the last 2 years. One in the journal Medical Hypotheses, the other in the Scandinavian Journal. I'm not sure where the other one was published, but she's actually really, for the first time in the psychiatric literature, beginning to spell out how it is that the various ways in which medication actually, neuroleptic medication, particularly for schizophrenia, creates the situation where people end up in a self-fulfilling prophecy, that
mm-hmm.
if they stop taking their medication too quickly, things happen as a result of that, which may be a withdrawal state similar to the sort of states that occur with benzodiazepines. Maybe it's a complex state partly to do with not being able to sleep and being anxious and having the expectation that those are early indicators of, quote, relapse, unquote. Or even possibly, in some cases, what's called a supersensitivity psychosis or rebound psychosis.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there's a real need to open that up. But I think one of the things that Rufus has done through his work on, in his contribution to this, the document, but also his wider ideas about the importance of community support networks, is about beginning to change the cultural environment in regard to medication. If things happen to us biologically, you know, we have bodies, we have biology, we have neurochemistry going on up here. No matter what, let's just set neuroscience aside, those factors, if you like, cause us to have certain experiences which we want to put names to, and that's where culture fits in. Culture becomes a system. This is one very narrow aspect of, but this is where I'm so, you know, the whole issue of philosophy is so important here. The culture, if you like, provides systems that enable us to label and name and interpret experiences that don't fit into language, i.e. the sort of biological experiences we have as a result of our biology. And so that's why changing social attitudes is so important here. If you can create a social environment where people, they might have those experiences as they start to come off drugs, but if instead of seeing it in negative terms as relapse of schizophrenia, they see it as something that's to be expected and that it's something they're prepared for and it's something that they can, they've got support networks mm-hmm. around to help them negotiate it and to talk about it, then I think that the likelihood is much more that people will successfully come off medication, even if they've been on it for many years. And that's, there's a really important project just been finished by Mind in England, the main mental health charity called Coming Off, where they surveyed, I can't remember, it was a large number of people's experiences of coming off by themselves neuroleptic drugs. And the results of that are really interesting. They're just about to publish the final report, but what the next step now is to set up a national sort of program of doing that, of actually providing advice, providing guidance, providing support, enabling people at a local communities to come together to support each other coming off medication. Now that to me is a really exciting prospect, because there are probably tens and tens of thousands of people in Britain whose lives have been completely blighted by long-term neuroleptic medication, and I think that anything that can help people socially in that way, and this is one way of doing it, will be a tremendous thing.
If people aren't familiar with Mind, which is still a big mental health charity in Britain, they have a fantastic website, mind.org.uk.
I'm supporting someone at the moment who's come off medication. So mood stabilizer about 3 months ago, and she started to hear voices a couple of weeks ago. She'd never heard voices before 3 weeks ago, and the voices are telling her to kill herself. And you know, we're looking at it as well. It's quite understandable why she's hearing voices, because the system has shafted her. In many ways, because she's it's a complex story, but she's very much caught in a trap, and you could see why where this rage might be coming from, but we're also looking at it as a kind of reverse psychology, that she's the kind of person, if you tell her to do something, or she won't be able to, like I told her, she won't be able to give up cigarettes. She's going to give up cigarettes now. So maybe the voice is working on the same principle. You know? And so...
Let's hope.
And what the whole point of the hearing voices approach is that hearing voices isn't a problem. It's your relationship with that experience that is the problem. So it's similar to Buddhist psychology in a sense, that you accept everything. And you work on your relationship with it, and the Hearing Voices Network. So one of the things that's helped her is doing yoga. So that's created some mental space. The voices seem to have moved a bit back, and she's been able to create a kind of partition, an imaginary partition in her head, where the voices can be at the back having coffee and having their conversation, and she's in the front of her brain having her conversation with her thoughts. So, and by doing yoga and using this sort of image, she's been able to give herself some space and get sleep as well, get enough relaxation. So we try lots of different things. So there's something called binaural beat technology where people listen to rhythms, CDs, and that can create more delta waves in the brain, apparently. So you listen to different rhythms for half an hour before sleep, and it can help some people get a better quality sleep and have a deeper sleep. So we feel like we don't really know all the ways to support people coming off meds because we're at the beginning of a time when people are starting to do that. It's like, you know, so we're discovering all the time. It's just trying different things. And I guess what's really difficult for her is that her family are very much in denial about her problems. You know, that so she needs people she can feel safe with to talk about problem. That's a big, you know, so I'm trying, you know, introducing her to different people, different self-help groups, forums like Evolving Minds, where she feels she can connect, you know, she doesn't have to live in solitary confinement. Mm.
Yeah, it's almost two, and some people will have to move now. And Janine has a creativity group that meets here at two, so we're going to have to wrap up. But I like this idea that we don't know all the ways to help people yet. That's very helpful.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I've got a guide how to set up Hearing Voices groups that I've bought.
Yeah, I've got a lot of this stuff too.
Oh, you got that? Yeah. So, well, Gail's got it, so you can have a look at it here, though. And there's a guide from Quebec about medication withdrawal reduction.
Do we have time for one more question?
Yeah.
I'm very interested in, because meeting Rufus and Phil last year, it was very much like looking through the looking glass. But I saw so many parallels between what the Freedom Center is doing and what the people we've been working with here are doing, and also Windhorse is doing. And yet there seems to be some kind of real difference between the England experience and the U.S. experience. And I'm wondering if you can maybe speak to what you think those differences might be, because we haven't, Freedom Center's work, we haven't been able to get that kind of foothold into the institutional settings. I mean, I've never actually done presentations with a psychiatrist, for example, and having that kind of backing. And maybe you were able to get your own degree, and you were able to get, I think that also you mentioned MIND, the main, we have NAMI in the U.S., which is maybe parallel to MIND.
Hang on.
It's parallel in the sense of prominence and importance and the group you think of.
Yeah.
But like the looking glass analogy is a very different, it's kind of like the Star Trek episode where there's the good Enterprise and there's the evil Enterprise or something, I don't know. So, because I think, I mean, I'm very excited to see this dialogue happening, and I want to see more of these things kind of happen. I really appreciate Kermit's work for getting more collaboration on the local level between Freedom Center and that approach and Windhorse approach, and really trying to make these spaces happening. The Republicans just took a trouncing in the elections. I think there's a tremendous opening. My experiences from doing this work for about more than 5 years now, so there's much more openness. Maybe this is also, I'm sure this is also true in England too, to these kinds of perspectives. And I think now might be the time for some kind of more thinking along collaborative lines, keeping in mind that maybe we're up against some challenges here that you guys don't have, or they're different in the UK.
I think your point about political leadership is really important, and I sense a different mood here compared with 2 years ago. When I was here, it's exactly 2 years ago this time, after the last elections when Bush got in. In 97, when Blair got in, I think there was a real sense that there was a sense of hope, and hope is so important. Hope is something that we all need. And I think that what's happened is that, although, you know, many of us hate Blair for what he's done in terms of his relationship with Bush, but I don't think there's any doubt, and I'd be interested in Gail's take on this as an external observer, that some of the policies that the Blair government has introduced in relation to healthcare and social care, especially around mental health, really are beginning to change things. And I think that you need the encouragement and the vision of political leaders to say that partnerships and alliances between different groups in society is something that's valued, something that's really important. That the contributions of ordinary people to debates about their health and well-being are absolutely vital. And if you look at the way that Blair set up his mental health policy, He did that through what I think many people consider to be a genuinely democratic attempt. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a good point about political leadership.
I'd like to ask people to move the conversation out into the dining room, and please put your cushions in a circle for the group that's going to be here at 2.